To start, I'll have everybody turn to Isaiah 55, and we're going to be looking at verses 8 and 9 as the fundamental text for the challenge this afternoon. I've been reminded several times by a couple different people to keep it short, so my wife being one of them. She remembers all too well my Sunday school lessons that raged long past 11:45. So Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9 says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Past several times that I have been asked to teach, I've talked about work, something related to work, and for better or worse, I felt like that series had, at least in my mind, sort of run its course, and I felt like it was the last message that I gave was a good wrapping up of that theme. So even though I don't necessarily have the platform at this point, and I'm hoping that I'll have the opportunity to teach the adult Sunday school class at some point, I don't have the platform to necessarily teach a series, but it certainly helps me as I'm preparing if I do almost approach it like that, so that the next time that I preach is just kind of expounding on generally the same theme. The other reason that I'd sort of like to introduce this idea and then sort of continue in, you know, the coming months as I have the opportunity is because it is a topic that has been on my mind a lot, and I've been thinking about it and meditating on the Bible's teachings and then looking at different philosophers, both secular and spiritual, for what they say about this issue. And I certainly can't teach everything that I'd like to in, you know, the next 25 minutes or so. So I think probably what will happen is I will be able to introduce this and we'll be able to talk about it. And then I'll give you guys the other points. I have three points apart from this introduction today, and we might be able to get into the first point in a little bit. But the theme here is a transcendent morality as it pertains to the existence of God. So philosophy and history and sort of how philosophy has evolved over time, it's a very fascinating topic to me personally, and it's perplexing in the sense that for a large percentage of human history, there's been a very strong spirituality, and I use that term very generally among most cultures. It's rooted in a variety of different religions, you know, from Far East religions to Western religions, Christianity predominantly. But recently, and I use the word recently as a history teacher, so I'm talking like the past several centuries, philosophy has really turned almost solely atheistic. And you can see that, I'm sure, in just the people that you all interact with on a day-to-day basis, that you know, American culture is very strongly turning to atheism just sort of as a general community psyche. That changes very much the way that we approach witnessing to people. You know, it used to be, there's people in this very room that can remember when culture was a little bit more steeped in Christianity and Judeo-Christian values, and witnessing to people with that general theme was a lot different because they had a basic knowledge of Christianity, and most of them believed in some form or another of God. And so you have a starting point when you witness to people like that, and you sort of know that, you know, you can build on what they already have been exposed to for, you're assuming, most of their life. America is one of the most churched nations, and of course those percentages are changing as well. But now, when we interact with people, you have to start at a completely different point because you can't really get into the teachings of Jesus if this person doesn't even believe that God exists to begin with. And trying to you know, take them to the Bible and say, you know, this is what the Bible teaches about these things, and they don't believe that God exists, then there's really no point for them using the Bible as a resource at all. And so what I'm hoping to explore in this topic is the idea that God exists and what philosophically and even logically leads us to that conclusion. There's a lot of extremely intelligent people in the United States and throughout the world that are atheists. And I use the word intelligent rather loosely because we all, as Christians, use that term to mean, you know, somebody whose knowledge is rooted in the Bible and its teachings. But I'm talking about people that are very intelligent in their fields. And so it can be very scary to try to talk to people that actually know what they're talking about when it comes to their atheistic beliefs, because they bring up some very compelling arguments sometimes. And that's the reason why a lot of people are turning from a religious worldview to an atheistic worldview. And so for me personally, it's been challenging, and it's sometimes actually rather scary to dive into this because of the nature of their arguments, and am I as a Christian able to refute their arguments? And if I can't refute their arguments, what does that mean? And so I'm not sure how many of you know who Sam Harris is. He's a very prominent atheist. Again, very intelligent person. He can speak on a lot of different things, and he actually has some really good ideas in his field, his philosophical field. Obviously, belief in God or his lack of belief in God is not one of them. But he is an extremely compelling voice when it comes to people who are atheistic and very, you know, very firmly rooted in that type of ideology. So, you know, being exposed to him, and then of course other secular philosophers that argue for an existence of God but may not have a saving faith in Jesus, and then of course Christian philosophers, and just kind of exposing myself to all of that, I've come to the conclusion that the strongest case to be made for the existence of God is the existence of what we would term as good and bad. And so that's what I'll be really going through. So I'll go ahead and give you guys sort of the first three main points that I'll go over. And again, we'll just really be able to introduce it today. The first one I have is titled The Standard. So that's the first main point. Then the second main point is things we do. And then the third is things we don't control. And so the first point, the standard, how do we get the standard of what is good and bad? Like, where do we come up with that? Then the third, things that we do, so things that we can personally control, what makes the things that we control, the decisions that we make, what makes those good or bad? And then things we can't control, what makes those good or bad? So think like natural disasters versus deciding that you are going to leave the faith, right? You can make a decision personally and you control that. You can't really control if a tornado wrecks your house. So how do we define good and bad in those situations, and how does the Bible define it? Where do we come up with these standards? So it seems extremely simplistic in the sense that really when it comes down to it, all we're talking about is what's good and what's bad. What's good and what's bad? And you go, well, I know what's good and bad based on my life experiences and the teachings that I've received throughout my life at church and all of these things. But you have to understand that when you're talking to somebody who's unsaved and is particularly an atheist, you have to start at that point. It's a realization that I've come to as a football coach. If you coach high school football, you assume that your players have already played for a couple years, that they know how to do basic things like block and tackle. They understand X's and O's if you draw them on paper. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of them don't understand that. And so as a coach, you go into that environment assuming that they all know, and they're completely lost, and you have nothing to build on. It's the same thing if you witness to somebody that's an atheist. If you just go in assuming that they believe in God, assuming that their moral values are the same as yours or at least similar to yours, you may be completely off base, because if you're an atheist, where do your morals even come from to begin with, right? So that's what we're going to look at. Unfortunately, in this debate and in Yeah, it is a debate. The debate, you know, whether or not God fundamentally exists. A lot of the loudest voices in support of God's existence are people who are unsaved. one of those loudest voices is Dr. Jordan Peterson, who argues very strongly for the existence of God and has a lot of podcasts and lectures about the Bible. He's extremely well studied in the Bible. I don't know that he's personally saved. But he has used his platform as a psychologist and as somebody who knows a lot about philosophy to really, from an objective standpoint, argue for the existence of God and for a higher transcendent version of morality that governs our life and how important that is in cultures so that we don't just veer into anarchy. And I think that that's pretty unfortunate that the loudest voice is someone who I don't know has a saving faith in Jesus. So what is it that prevents Christians from entering this argument? I think that it's twofold. I think there's two reasons why Christians don't dive into this head first and really take on this atheistic ideology. The first, I think, is a lack of spiritual maturity among the church in general, and I use that term universally. Paul in the New Testament talks about Christians being infants, so that they still have to be fed the milk of the word as opposed to the meat of the word. And our churches today are full of Christians that are like that. Pastor teaching on fundamentalism and then contemporary movements. The contemporary movement is, I would argue, made up almost entirely of people who are still infants in the word. So if they are saved, if they go to a church that actually preaches the gospel, how far in their Christian walk are they? Probably not very far, because most of what they hear from the pulpit is not very challenging to them. And we all know that you can't grow in Christ if you're not being challenged on a very consistent basis. So how can you enter into the fray of arguing for the existence of God against very intelligent, well-educated people if you don't even know your own Bible? If you have not been consistent in your own devotions, if you don't take it upon yourself to study these things out, you're going to be too scared to enter those arguments, and you're going to withdraw from it. The second reason, I think, is fear. It's pretty obvious. People don't want to get persecuted. People don't want to appear too ignorant. I already alluded to that. And they're worried that they're going to be scorned because, again, the most intelligent people that the world places on these pedestals of the most learned, who are they? Evolutionists, atheists, and if you start making an argument for God, most people in the academic world are already mocking you because you might as well just try to explain to them how you bought your house because you got, you know, three wishes from a genie, and one of them was for, well, at this point you have to wish for like $500,000 to afford a home, but that's basically what, they'll look at you like you're someone that believes in fairies and magic and all this kind of stuff, because that's the point that we've gotten to in academia. Another issue that I kind of see is that Christians use the reasons that I just talked about, this lack of spiritual maturity, this fear of being persecuted, but that we have a very easy way out to explain why it is that we're not willing to make this argument. And that is the word separation. If we, you know, if we're supposed, we're not supposed to be worldly. The Bible talks about in the New Testament specifically, but also in the Old Testament in referring to the children of Israel, how we're supposed to be a people set apart, how we're not supposed to, the children of Israel are not supposed to adopt the idolatry, the idol worship of the people that they were forcing out of the land of Canaan. And so a very easy excuse as to why you're not going to confront somebody and make an argument for the existence of God, or why you're not going to witness to somebody that's unsaved, is that, you know, it's just a really easy way out. Well, I need to separate from them because they're unsaved and they live a life that I would not live, and that's probably true. But separation should be a principle. It shouldn't be an excuse to remove yourself from the world. And lest you think that I'm just sharing my opinion with you. Paul actually teaches this in 1 Corinthians 5. So if you go to 1 Corinthians 5, this is a passage that we've actually been going through in the new young adults class. And I highlighted this verse in particular, and we talked about it because I like to focus on things that are like ministry-minded with the young adults right now, and just how to minister to people that are our age. And a lot of that does have to do with how do you approach somebody who's a straight-up atheist. So I've got to get to the right version, or else I'm not going to be able to find my highlights here. So I'm reading from the NASB because I have my devotions in this. So just if you're having trouble following along, I'm in verse 10. Paul is saying, and in verse 9 he says, you're not supposed to associate with people who are sexually immoral. But in verse 10 he says, I did not at all mean the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the greedy and swindlers, or with idolaters, for then you would have to leave the world. But actually I wrote to you, in verse 11, not to associate with any so-called brother. So this is somebody who's a Christian who is living out sinful habits in his life. So Paul is very specific here that you are to separate from a believer who has sin in his life. There's church discipline, and the Bible goes through how all that's supposed to take place. And unfortunately, we've seen it in this church from time to time, luckily not very often. But we're not supposed to separate from people who live that way in the world. And I'm not talking about being yoked with that person, where you're dependent and you're relying on that person in a like a marriage relationship. That's usually how that verse is applied, right? Don't be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. We're talking about like actual like physical separation, to where my coworker is living with his girlfriend, and so therefore I'm going to separate myself from him and I'm not going to talk to him anymore because he's living a sinful life. Would that be the biblical thing to do? No, according to this passage, it's not. I'm supposed to continue witnessing to him. I'm supposed to appropriately associate myself with him so that I can reach him for Christ. Right? If Jesus, his last commandment, go out into the world. Okay? He doesn't say, go live in a monastery and separate yourself from everything that's sinful. Don't allow it to affect you. Don't allow sin to enter your life because of your associations, because of where you work, because of your responsibilities in the world. But you've still got to go to work. You still got to interact with people that are unsaved. If you only ever interact with people who believe the same thing as you, then you're not living according to what the Bible calls us to do. So it's very, very dangerous to sort of misappropriate the term and the principle of separation in the Bible to mean, we're just going to completely remove ourselves from people that are unsaved. Some examples of this would be the public school system. Once the public school system began teaching evolution, once it removed prayer, a lot of Christians, and I'm not criticizing decisions that they make for their kids, but a lot of Christians just said, well, we're going to separate from that. The just absolute atrocity that is public education today, believe it or not, is the fault of a lot of Christians and communities that have removed themselves from school boards, that have decided that they're never going to teach in a public school. That Christian influence in public schools was removed voluntarily because a lot of Christians just said, well, I'm never going to associate with this ever again. I'm not even going to have the debate about evolution versus creation. I shouldn't have to be persecuted for prayer. So instead of standing up in my classroom, having my devotions at my desk in the morning before the students come in and being able to withstand the persecution that might come, I'm just going to go teach at a Christian school, or our kids are going to be homeschooled, and that's the way that it's going to be. And I'm speaking as somebody who both went to a Christian school and was homeschooled. So I understand the philosophy of parents today. It's like, well, public schools are so bad, and yeah, they are, but why is that? That's because a lot of Christians in the community decided, well, we're just going to sit back. We're just going to completely separate ourselves from something rather than say, no, I'm going to join this fight. I'm going to fight the fight that I need to hold on to this until it gets to the point where I just simply can't be involved in it anymore. But you know, I have to be essentially physically forced out of this. I'm not going to give it up. We've just kind of voluntarily given that up. We've given up in a lot of ways on government, right? You can't be involved in government because it's so corrupt, because there's so much sin, because you know, the lives that most politicians leave are just so disgusting, and so we're just going to completely separate ourselves from it. Well, now, again, you don't have that influence, that positive influence in government anymore. And the list goes on. You have to leave, you know, maybe your city elects LGBT plus supporting council members, and so you stop going to city council meetings and voicing your opinion there. Your coworkers are unkind or mean to you, and so your excuse is, well, I can't work this job because these people are unsaved, and I'm going to separate myself from them. So instead of having a witness to people that are unsaved, I'm just going to go work where it's really comfortable, and nobody questions my faith anymore. Separating from unbelievers severely and abruptly is rarely the right choice. Most of the time, what you should do is stand up and be comfortable enough in that situation to do the right thing. Reaching the end of our introduction here, in the next several messages and challenges that I bring, I would like to explore the biblical foundation for our morality by defining some of the most simple, yet at the same time, complex words that we have in our language, which is the words good and bad. So how do we define that? So let's go back to our foundational text of Isaiah 55, 8 through 9, and read that again. Because this is extremely important basing our belief in God and making the argument for his existence based on the very existence of these words. Okay? For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. God is saying here that he has his by his character a path. Okay? And that path involves things that are both good and bad. Okay? And God allows us as individuals to make the choice between doing the wrong thing or the right thing. And the most complicated thing to explain to somebody who's an atheist is that a God who is all good allows people to make choices that can be all wrong. And that's a scary thing to think about, because it seems like you're contradicting yourself on its face, but you're not. Okay? And so in the following points, I'm going to talk about why those things can absolutely coexist. Okay? But we have to be okay with agreeing in the sense that a way that an atheist would bring up this argument, that bad things happen in the world, bad things happen to good people, and we serve an all-good God who is all-powerful and all-knowing. Okay? Because we have to agree that there are bad things that happen in the world, right? There's tragedies that are within people's control. Okay? Atrocities throughout history where millions of people have been killed. Those are bad things. How can God allow that to happen? Okay? At the same time, if God is not all-good, then the being that we serve really is not worthy of service, correct? So reconciling these ideas and not being afraid to approach them, that is where we have to start and to say, no, I'm not afraid of any points that you can bring up, because nothing's going to refute the fundamental fact that God does exist, that he did create the world, and that the very essence of our morality as beings and what defines good and bad is rooted in him. Amen. And not just his decisions, but who he actually is as a capital P person. His very character defines for us everything that is good and bad. And so that is actually the end of my time. So Again, the next 3 points, I'll talk about the standard. So how do we get to defining good and bad? And then I'll talk about things that we do, choices that we make. How can God allow somebody to make a bad decision that ends up having negative effects on multiple people? And then what about natural disasters? Or what about things that are outside of our control? So somebody apart from me makes a decision that negatively affects me, and it could be in a very severe way. You're the victim of someone murdered a family member or something terrible like that. How can God allow that to happen? Okay, so we'll look at that in the coming months as I have opportunity. So let's close in prayer.